Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to our audience and our listeners around our world. I'm Maria, I'm your host for Inner Sight. And also, Jocelyn is also an educator teacher, and she's also the host for Inner Sight on Sundays. And so we're going to welcome Jocelyn. Welcome.
Thank you, Maria. And I brought along another guest today. Her name is Amy Gravino. She is the board treasurer at GRASP, which is an adult group for those with autism. She has studied applied behavioral analysis. I know for a fact, because I know Amy personally, she's a phenomenal young woman. Right now, she's starting her own business. But tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about a subject that's a little bit taboo, because Amy is also known to many as the Naughty Autie. That's right. If you haven't guessed our subject yet tonight, it's about sex on the spectrum. And we're going to keep tonight's topic as PG as possible. But this is a really important topic. I think that, in talking with a lot of my friends who have children on the spectrum, or, in talking with a lot of people who are on the spectrum, it's really not discussed. And, one of the things that I have a friend who brings it up constantly is, how do I talk to my child about this? And, for any parent who has a neurotypical child, the discussion is difficult enough. When you're talking about somebody who's on the spectrum, there's a whole different outlook for it, and there are a lot of issues and challenges on the subject of sex that, that don't present themselves when you're talking about a neurotypical individual. So, Amy, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you this evening?
Oh, thank you for having me, Jocelyn. I'm very well. I'm just returned from a long vacation, and this is my first kind of big event out of the gate. I'm very pleased to be on the show, and I hope that I can help answer some of the questions that some of the listeners out there might have about autism and Asperger's syndrome and sexuality. And I'm an open book, so my life is here to share with you all. As you said, I have been calling myself the Naughty Autie, which is actually the title of my book that I'm currently writing and trying to find a publisher for, which is about my experiences as a woman on the spectrum with dating and sexuality and relationships, issues that differ, actually, than those faced by men on the spectrum, which is a whole other, we could do an entire show devoted just to issues faced by women on the spectrum alone. So it's a unique kind of single girl perspective. It's like Sex in the City meets autism kind of thing. So I'm just very happy to be here, and I hope that I can illustrate some things more clearly for your listeners out there, and thank you for having me.
And we are absolutely excited to have you on tonight. Before we get into the real nitty gritty, what gave you the idea to be the Naughty Autie?
It started actually back when I was seeing film for Normal People Scare Me, which I co-starred in with your sister Jocelyn. When I had met Carrie Bowers, who co-directed the film, she actually christened me the Naughty Autie because of my openness and frankness about sexuality. I later came to find out that there was another woman with autism who had sort of been calling herself that, Donna Williams. She is Australian. She is a very vocal autism advocate. And I actually communicated with her a couple times via email, and she gave me her blessing and said that I could go forth and be the Naughty Autie, even though she had been kind of using that moniker before I did. The idea just sort of came because I am willing to talk about anything. I know you said you wanted to keep this PG, but it's hard to do that because this is a subject that can't be sugar-coated. Because we're dealing with a population on the spectrum, we can't use colorful euphemisms necessarily because people might not know what we're talking about. So we need someone who's willing to tell it like it is. And I feel that is kind of my role. I mean, the only other really strong female person on the spectrum who has been in the limelight is Temple Grandin, who is fabulous and wonderful, but she is not interested in issues of sexuality and relationships. That's not something that has ever crossed her fancy, and she doesn't like to talk about it. So I kind of see myself as picking up where she left off, and that's how that kind of all came about.
So now when we when we talk about the birds and the bees talk, the big talk, I know that when I was young, my parents had it with me. I don't know too many parents who don't approach the subject in some way. But with your parents, how did they approach you in talking about sex?
Well, that's the thing. They didn't. We were faced with a lot of issues when I was growing up, lots of issues dealing with the school and special ed things and social skills. And sexuality, that was just something that there was no room for because of everything else that was going on. So we never really had the traditional talk, you know, sitting down and going over things like that. And I think that kind of talk actually needs to start when children are around 10 years old, 11, not explicit, but starts with the basics. And we didn't do that. And so by the time my parents maybe tried to broach the subject with me, maybe when I was 13 or 14, that's the middle school years, and that's when puberty kicked in, and I was just kind of shut off from them. I didn't want to talk to them about anything, let alone sex. So if they made any kind of instigations at that point, it never went anywhere because I was just a complete mess. So we never had a real talk like that in any sense of the word.
Now, when you bring up the age, 10 or 11, is there something developmentally that parents can look for? Because I know when puberty hits, you get into this, well, I don't want to talk to mom about my boyfriend or anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, my understanding, I look at my twin sister and she's, you and I are both the same age, and we're 28, and that's not a subject that she is emotionally, on the developmental side, ready to address in depth. Is there anything that parents can look for in a developmental sense that, maybe it's not 10 or 11, but, they're starting to show these signs or anything that, maybe it's time we sit down and start addressing these issues even lightly?
Well, the way I like to look at things is prevention before, it's like when people get older and they end up taking 10 or 11 pills a day to deal with all these heart conditions and things like that. These are things that could have been dealt with before they happened. You modify your diet or you get more exercise when you're younger, and then you don't have to take all these pills later on in life. And it's the same thing with the sexuality stuff. A lot of times it doesn't come up until a person on the spectrum has gotten into some kind of trouble. Be it physically, emotionally, or legally even. You hear all too often about males on the spectrum not understanding the boundaries involved in courting a girl, and they end up stalking a girl not even realizing that's what they're doing, or they engage in inappropriate sexual behaviors and then, get arrested for indecent exposure. And you want to address all that before that stuff happens. You don't want someone to be in the legal system and have a sexual offender marker on their name, paintballing them for the rest of their life when that's not at all who they are, and the circumstances of what happened are completely different from what the label implies. So puberty is starting earlier and earlier. That's why I mentioned 10 or 11. But, children recognize the difference between boys and girls pretty young. They see, Susie doesn't have this thing between her legs that I have between my legs. What does that mean? And basically, when you want to start is when they start asking. Because the questions do come, even if they don't come in the way you're expecting. Sometimes children blurt things out when we don't even expect it. But it's important not to shy away. If they're looking to you for these answers, that's when you have to give them to them, because otherwise they'll do what I did, which is turn to their peers and get advice and answers from their peers. And so a lot of people on the spectrum like rules. They like a set list of guidelines. Well, let's say you have a son who is going to want to be exploring himself. You want to have a list of guidelines so that he knows where and when it's appropriate to do that. Only in your bedroom, only when you're alone. Set all that out in advance, and it's prevention. It's preventing some unfortunate incident from happening down the line. So, but when they start to show interest, when they start to ask those questions, that's, I think, the best time to get going with that. And again, they might not ask it in the traditional sense that you would think of. You have to pay more attention than you might think you have to. So,
and that would be why the talk is really essential. And I think a lot of that is, you know, we, and I'm neurotypical. Everybody who listens, they, you all know I'm not autistic, and you know, we have our own set of issues in entering, you know, in the world of sex and sexual relationships, and those, you know, are highly publicized, and you can read about it, you can watch it on TV, you know, with different sitcoms and all of that. But with somebody who's autistic, what are some of the unique issues? And you can speak about this from, of course, being autistic or being an autistic woman. What are some of those unique issues that come up with being on the spectrum and sex and sexual relationships?
Well, one of the first ones to come to my mind, although this hasn't exactly been my experience, is sensory issues. We know a lot of people on the autism spectrum have sensory issues, and that certainly can extend into the bedroom. If a person doesn't like to be touched, that's going to make it difficult to engage in physical intimacy. If they, you know, don't like the smell of body scents or sweat, that will also present a challenge. Some people might express an interest in sex, but because of the sensory issues, it creates a barrier. But beyond the sensory issues, I think it's more of an emotional vulnerability. Everybody says that when you're young, you're more vulnerable, and a lot of young people aren't ready for sex because of all the emotional weight it carries. Imagine you're someone on the spectrum who takes people at their word, who believes what people tell you, and then add love into that, falling for someone and wanting to be physical with them, and you don't have a whole lot of kind of rational thinking going on. I just think there's just great more vulnerability when it comes to people on the spectrum to be manipulated. Women on the spectrum are far more likely to be sexually assaulted than neurotypical women because of that. And, you know, I just think that the population as a whole, you want people who aren't going to take advantage of this population, because that can happen in several ways, being taken advantage of physically, as I said, emotionally, and there are people who are going to exploit that very readily. So that is part of what happened to me in my own life. You know, my very first time was with someone who I had fallen in love with, but who did not love me back, even though I thought that he did. And I later found out that he'd had a girlfriend the whole time, and he'd been lying, and so I got my heart broken good and hard, and it's tough. You don't want to have to learn that lesson that way, but that was how it happened for me. Part of it is the fact that he was lying, and part of it is that I saw what I wanted to see. I had the rose-colored glasses on because I was vulnerable. I was on my own. I was 3,000 miles away from my friends and family, so that put me in a position to really be taken advantage of. I own up to that. I accept my responsibility in that, but that was something that shook me to my foundations. And I blamed myself for a long time for my bad judgment. I said, oh my gosh, this is my fault. It's the stupid Asperger's, my bad judgment. And that can lead to, that's a unique issue as well, that a person on a spectrum can take something so to heart and feel so defeated that they won't want to try again. If you get rejected so many times, you're going to eventually stop trying. And I haven't dated for the past 7 years because of that, largely, because I've been so afraid, not of men, but of my judgment when it comes to men. So that, I think, those are, I think, some of the unique issues that individuals on the spectrum face when it comes to sex and the sexual relationship.
And that makes a lot of sense because, you know, and just with experiences with people I've met on the spectrum and my sister, when you come to formulate a rule, it's a hard and fast rule. It's not, you know, me, I get heartbroken, you know, there's a period of time, but at a certain point, you know, I'm ready to meet people and jump back in the game, you know, if I'm in that place in my life. But I would imagine for somebody who's on the spectrum, it's just a new rule. It's a new routine when it comes to relationships. Is that far off, or does that sound about right?
No, I think that sounds right. That, I mean, again, that makes me think of, you know, I also have, like, established routines, and I believe that every time that this guy and I got together, we had to have sex because that's what we had done previously. I didn't realize until much, much later that we didn't have to. Just because we had done it previously didn't mean that we had to do it every time. But to me, this was the routine. He came over to my apartment. We hung out for a little while. We started kissing, and then the clothes came off, and there you go. Because that was always what happened. And because I was so naive and inexperienced, I was deferring to him. I didn't have an assertive role in the relationship. There's a great difference to myself now as opposed to back then, because I believed that because he was more experienced than I was, that I had to do whatever he said, that he knew better, that there was no possible way that I could know what was better for me. And that's a dangerous thing, too. That goes back to what we were talking about issues faced by people on the spectrum, is that we believe, because we spend a lot of our lives, or I did, being told, oh, you don't know that about yourself. Oh, I know what's better for you. I know what you need. Because you spend your life being told more about yourself, you don't know yourself. So you look to other people to tell you what's going on. And it can't be that way. You have to come to trust yourself and believe that you know what's best for you, and that doesn't come easy, but it's crucial.
So let's for instance, let's do a little bit of role playing for a minute. I'm going to be your autistic child, okay? And you're my mommy, and I'm at that crucial age, and let's say I brought up that I kissed a boy in class today. Mm-hmm. And now you're sensing, okay, you know, you're 11 years old, you're starting to kiss boys. What would you say to me if you were my parent, and knowing that I was on the spectrum in talking about sex and things like that?
I would say, you know, I would ask about if you enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it? Were you okay with it? Was this what you wanted? Because a lot of times, you know, if we're not the instigator, if the other person is the one who, you know, brings this about, we might not recognize it. You know, I could say I kissed a boy, but what really happened is that a boy ran up and kissed me and then ran away. But I don't recognize exactly what happened. So it's important to get more details, I think, because that singular statement doesn't necessarily tell the full story. You have to see exactly where the child is coming from, because, like I said, that won't give you the full picture. I think, and there's a disconnect, too, because I began to have that interest around that age, like most 11-year-olds, but I didn't actually kiss a boy until I was 17. So there's a difference between when the interest begins and when experience occurs. So even if the child isn't kissing the boy, they might just say it. They might say, I kissed a boy today, or you know, because they thought about it. They thought about it so much and wanted it so badly that it's almost like they did. So you have to make that distinction, I think, because you have to know where the child is coming from before you can know how best to address what they're saying to you, I think.
Okay. And that's true, because, you know, I remember there was a situation with my sister, and you know, she kissed a boy, and it was really, the situation was really vague, because we were young, and mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of unclear exactly what happened with that and how my parents should deal with it. You know, and I'm going to throw you another little curveball here, and this may or may not be offensive to anybody listening, but I know from stories and from my own experience that there are a lot of children on the spectrum who are into the whole stimulation, and mm-hmm. and that, you know, genital stimulation is a part of it, and yes. You know, and you start seeing this at a very, very young age. And it's not,
yes.
It has nothing to do with abuse. It has nothing to do with anything but
right.
the whole mechanism. And I say this to describe Jessica's mechanism with things like chocolate and fried food. It makes me feel good. I'm going to do it. And it doesn't matter who's there or what
right.
the situation is. Now, if you're talking about a child who's very young in that sort of situation, how would you, as again, in the role as a parent, address that child? Because that sort of stimulation
right.
isn't really socially inputted. It's just
right.
there.
Right. Well, again, that's an issue of impulse control. That's an issue of redirecting. You say to the child, okay, you don't want to shame them. The first thing you want to realize is you do not want to say this is bad, this is disgusting, this is wrong, because you will give the child a complex about body issues and about exploring these things when it's something that's perfectly healthy and natural. It's just, it's not happening in the right environment. So you don't want to put the child in a position to feel ashamed. Because if you had a neurotypical child who was exploring these same things, you know, the parents might laugh and say, oh, Tommy's playing with his winky. Okay, Tommy, go in your bedroom, put your pants down, and they're not out here. And it's the same thing for a child on the spectrum, but you have to be more direct. You can't, you know, laugh it off so much. You have to actually, in some cases, physically redirect the child to the appropriate place and explain why it has to be done in that particular place. And again, it's as someone on the spectrum, I spent a lot of my young life feeling like a freak every day, no matter what I did, whether it was appropriate or not, and I had no concept sometimes of what was appropriate or wasn't. And we're very aware of how apart we are from other people. And the funny thing is that this stuff, masturbation, exploration of the body, actually makes us a lot like other people, neurotypical people. So it's not something that we should be made to feel bad for. And it just needs that redirection, like I said, that actual prompting, sometimes physical prompting, to make sure that we are aware of the appropriate spaces for that activity. So
now, do you believe that sexuality and autism is the subject that needs a lot more attention than it has gotten?
Absolutely. I definitely think so. I think, I just finished my master's degree, as you said, in applied behavior analysis. And for my thesis, we were required to design and implement a study of our own creation. And my study was that I taught adult males with Asperger's how to ask someone out on a date. And part of what we had to do was do a literature review in which we looked into the existing research studies to see what had been done previously. And there was nothing on dating. I mean, there was plenty of studies that addressed social skills and all kinds of other similar things, but there was nothing with dating, almost nothing, for an Asperger's or autism population. So it is something. A lot of people are uncomfortable addressing these issues, you know, and I always say this, I've said this before, that you have to get past the blushing cheek phase. I don't care if it embarrasses you. This is important. This is essential because this is your child's future and how they're going to end up viewing the world. It's going to shape that. And you have to get past it. So I definitely think that it's under-addressed. Some people still do believe that individuals on the spectrum, if you have autism or Asperger's, you don't have sex. I've heard so many horror stories, like doctors who prescribe medications to a person with Asperger's and don't let them know that one of the side effects is erectile issues, and the person, the individual, was touching themselves so roughly they ended up causing damage. But the doctor never told them that was a side effect. And when the person's psychologist spoke to the doctor said, oh, well, he has autism. He doesn't have sex. So this is an egregious misconception, obviously, and the fact that this could still be perpetuated is horrifying to me. And I do think it is under-addressed, and that is part of why I'm so willing to speak openly about these issues. I definitely think, and especially from a female perspective, we've been getting a lot of male perspectives of relationships and sex, but the female side is not really touched on that much. And that's partially due to society's, you know, dislike of female sexuality in general. let alone in the autistic population. But it definitely needs to be touched on more, I think.
Absolutely. And you know, when and Maria brings this up a lot with, you know, we talk about how I think that the number now, it keeps changing, so if I'm incorrect, forgive me. I think the number of boys that they're diagnosing on the spectrum now is somewhere in the 1 in 54 range. So you're talking about 2% of the male population is considered to be on the spectrum. And the female number sort of floats off in the distance somewhere. It isn't addressed. A lot of that on the female side of it is, I think, that being on the spectrum for a male really manifests itself more behaviorally. So you're going to see a lot more behaviors out of a young boy than out of a young girl. And you come to this issue where there's already an issue among all women when you talk about abuse in relationships, when you talk about being sexually exploited, when you talk about being, you know, assaulted and raped and basically taken advantage of from a sexual standpoint. And my philosophy on this at the moment is that, you know, girls are underdiagnosed, you know, and if they're underdiagnosed, the portion of it that deals with sexuality is grossly overlooked. And so you have a population of young women who didn't really get the talk for whatever reason, whether they whether there was no interest in sex at the time or, like in your case, you know, it just wasn't addressed for other social reasons. And now you have a population of young women who not only have issues reading social cues and understanding the complex world of sex and a sexual relationship, but you now have these girls who not only don't understand any of that, you know, they don't play the game, and now they're being taken advantage of and have no clue why. And, it, you know, the fact that it is under-addressed is really a problem. Because, you know, we tell neurotypical girls that they're empowered and they have the power and, you know, no means no. And we have all these catchphrases for the neurotypical girls who in their teenage years are going out there and dating. But this message gets completely bypassed when you're talking about girls on the spectrum. 'Cause the message isn't addressed to them. The message is addressed to everybody else. And it really is, you know, no means no. Okay, well, what does that have to do with me? If somebody said to me no means no, I understand what that means without any other explanation. A young woman or an adult who's on the spectrum maybe didn't get that message, definitely not because that person is stupid. I'm not implying that at all, but because the undertone of the message doesn't get picked up by the autistic frame of mind. It just doesn't. Without those in-depth talks and explanations that are desperately needed.
I think, you know, for women in general, a lot of our sexuality is hinged on having permission. We need permission from the male members of society to embrace our own sexuality, which I disagree with completely. But then when you're on the spectrum, everything you do is looked at through a neurotypical gaze, because whether or not something is correct or appropriate is deemed such by someone who is neurotypical. And so who we are as people and whatever sexuality begins to emerge from us, again, is filtered through that very same lens. Because I can remember in high school when I developed a crush on a boy, I remember someone, I don't know who exactly, but I remember having it said to me, you're not allowed to like him, you're not allowed to date him, and I believed it. I believed that permission from my peers was required for me to feel what I felt, let alone date who I wanted to date. Because, again, what I said before about deferring to those who are neurotypical, who I believe knew better than I did about myself. So it took many years before I was able to move past that and see I'll like whoever I damn well want to like, and I will date whoever I want to date because it's my choice, it's my life, and because I am allowed to feel the things that I'm feeling, these crushes I have or whatever it is I feel for another person, those feelings are mine. I own them. Nobody else is directing them for me. And that's just not something that girls and women on the spectrum are automatic, you know, the messages, like you said, the messages that come from the media, that come from society, do aim more for neurotypical girls and women who don't deal with any kind of disability. And it is disappointing because although we may see the world differently, although we may face certain issues related to dating and sexuality, we still have a right to be in a relationship. We have a right to happiness as much as anybody else. And I feel like a lot of people forget that, and so it gets overlooked, which is very frustrating.
And it is because, you know, when you brought up Temple Grandin earlier, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of people on the spectrum who consider themselves to be asexual, which means mm-hmm. they don't necessarily have an interest in intimacy
right.
or sex with others. But mm-hmm. but that's not a gross, you know, that's not a blanket statement. You're going to find
right.
people who aren't on the spectrum who consider themselves to be asexual as well. You're just not going to hear all too much about them. And
right.
on top of that, those people who are not on the spectrum, who are asexual, still get these messages about sex and understand them and
yes.
can navigate them better than somebody who has an autistic frame of mind. And so
mm-hmm.
anybody who's listening out there who may think, you know, oh, my child, you know, oh, they're not going to be interested in sex and that's just not going to happen. That might be a true statement. And I say might emphatically because just as much as it might be a true statement, it may not be a true statement. And
right.
regardless of whether your child, when they enter adulthood, chooses to engage in sexual relationships or not, they definitely need to be armed, especially if you're a girl. Guys, I hate to have to say this. Guys have it a lot easier. They don't have it perfect. Nobody does. But guys definitely have it a little easier than the ladies do.
Absolutely.
And if you're a woman on the spectrum, it's exponentially more difficult in that world. And as a parent or as not necessarily an educator, you know, it depends on a lot of factors in that, but as a parent of a child on the spectrum, that regardless of whether your child chooses, you know, the lifestyle of no sex or chooses a lifestyle with a partnership or intimacy or sexual relationships, this
mm-hmm.
is not a subject, you know, just because your child doesn't bring it up. You know, my sister never brought up sex growing up. That's
right.
not in there because chances are it is.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't leave that one behind.
I can tell you I was probably the most prudish little 15-year-old on the outside. You know, I would gasp when people would swear. But on the inside, I was a hotbed of sexual curiosity. I had so much that was going through my head. I'm a writer, so I used to write a lot back then. And I wrote erotic pieces, and that was my way of exploring because I had no way, you know, most teenagers, they'll kiss other teenagers and they'll explore things in that way, but I had no way to do that, so my outlet was through my writing. And that was how I, you know, explored these things because I felt I couldn't talk to anybody about them. I couldn't express this any other way. So, but these things were most certainly inside of me, these questions, these curiosities and these frustrations, the fact that whenever I would see on TV or in the movies a relationship between a guy and a girl, I could never identify with it because I could never see myself in that female role. It was restrictive, and I felt that I couldn't fill that part the way that I was supposed to. So I would get down on myself because of that. And so these things were all in me, even if I wasn't expressing it aloud. Although I will say that in 10th grade, I wrote a very sexy story for an English class assignment, and as a result, I asked me to read it in the hallway, and I got suspended for a day as a result. So what we talked about before about inappropriate, about redirect, you know, that was what they're encouraging. They said, come on, let's hear it. And I thought that they wanted to be my friend, and that's why I went ahead and capitulated, but I was just a sideshow freak to them. And as soon as it was over, they went back to ignoring me. So yes, all this was in me at that point, all this curiosity, but it was all coming out in all the wrong ways. And as you can see, perhaps my peers are the ones who should have gotten in trouble there, but I was the one who was punished. So that shouldn't have happened. And I'm hoping that through what I'm doing, through talking about sexuality and the spectrum, that won't happen to anyone else who's on the spectrum who was in my age. So
now, as an aside, because there might be some people listening who have this question, and I'm asking it from the devil's advocate point of view. Isn't this just what any kid in the stage of teenagerdom is experiencing? And how are you sure that this is unique to the autistic experience?
How am I sure what is unique to the autistic experience? Which part?
The whole idea that, you know, you're like the story that you just told where, you weren't brought up or, you know, talked to a lot about sexuality, so you went underground with it. That's kind of the story that we're getting about it. How would you respond to somebody who says, well, that's just any kid? How can you say that it's only the autistic individual?
Well, I think it could be universal, certainly. I think a lot of teenagers could have this happen, on the spectrum or not, but I think what makes it unique for the person on the spectrum is not understanding the mistake that might have been made. You know, with a neurotypical person, you know, they could see what went wrong and how not to repeat it, but that wasn't the case for me. I did not have that sort of ability to learn from that mistake, unless the only way I would know not to do what happened again is that the same exact situation arose, because I would say, okay, I was in this exact same situation before, so now I know not what to do. But if the situation was almost the same, but just a little bit different, I would not recognize that, and I would not be able to not make that mistake again. So the
generalization part of it, like, well, you know, I wasn't supposed to read it in the hallway. I probably shouldn't read it on the auditorium stage or to a group of people. And that's true. It's my sister is very much the same way, where if it's not the exact same thing, it's not the exact same thing.
Exactly.
And I think you're right. I think if you're talking about somebody who's neurotypical, you know, okay, I got in trouble in the hallway for doing this, which means I'll probably get in trouble here and here and everywhere for doing it.
Right.
And that generalization just doesn't exist.
Yes.
When you're talking about somebody on the spectrum, it's very, very specific. And so this kind of all leads me to my next couple of questions, where let's take a young autistic woman, she's a teenager. If you had any piece of advice for a young woman in that situation when it comes to sexual relationships, what would you tell her?
If a young woman had a question?
Let's say a young woman, you know, you're just talking about it, about sex to this young woman, and she's on the spectrum. She's a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what what advice would you give this young woman?
I would say, you know, there's nothing wrong with being interested in sex. There's nothing wrong with wanting to know what it's about. But make sure that what you do is what you want to do, that you feel safe, that you are not being talked into doing something that you don't really want to do. I'd say, you know, don't think that you're invincible either. I know a lot of young people fall into the trap of thinking that they can't get a disease or something like that, and so they don't use condoms or what have you, but I never had that. When I was getting ready to have sex for the first time, I made sure I was on the pill. I made sure that everything was set and in order. So make sure you know that there are consequences to this, and not just physical, but emotional, that it will have an effect on you, be it good or bad. I'd say, you know, I know this is a lot to take in, and it's not all going to make sense right away. You're going to start to explore things and not understand things at first. You're going to literally stare at some of these body parts and say, I'm supposed to do what with that? Because it won't, even if you thought about it 100 times, when you actually go to do it, it's a completely different experience. So I'd say, even if you have thought about it, even if you think you know everything there is to know about it, it is vastly different when you're actually there and doing it. And that's okay. That's okay. That's how you learn. You start somewhere and you move from there. And it's okay to be nervous. It's okay to not know what you're doing. As time goes by, you'll get to know what you're doing. So like I said, always make sure it's what you want to be doing and that you are okay and comfortable with the person that you're with, that you can trust them. Always make sure that this is someone that you trust and who you know you can be yourself with and who will respect you, who will respect your sensory issues, if you have any, who will respect anything else that comes up. It's crucial. So I think that's more or less what I'd say.
And would your advice change for somebody, and my understanding of your situation was that you were a little bit older, would your advice change for somebody who's older? Or, I mean, that sounds pretty much like what you'd want to say to anybody, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, my mother would always say, like when I was 18, Amy, you're 18 with an asterisk, meaning that chronologically I might be a certain age, but emotionally, developmentally, someone might not be the same age they are chronologically. So even if someone is 30, 32, whatever, it doesn't mean that emotionally that's where they're at. So I think it is sound advice to give, no matter what age somebody is.
And now for parents who might be listening in tonight, if you had one piece of advice for them, what would that piece of advice be?
need to go, because what happens to kids on the spectrum? They grow up. They become teenagers. And with that territory comes these sets of issues that you have to address. But don't be afraid to address them. Realize that you are not just dealing with Asperger's syndrome. You're not just dealing with autism. You're dealing with a person who is a teenager and who wants the same things everybody else wants, whether they're on the spectrum or not. So listen to your child. Listen to what they're saying, even if they're not speaking out loud, because they might still be communicating with you in other ways. And pay attention. And don't be afraid to be there for them. Even if they don't think they need you, they might still need you. So pay attention.
And now, there's always, you know, the one question I've always had is the idea, and I don't mean for this to sound like, oh, the idea is so foreign, and because it's not, you know. There's the aspect of a neurotypical autistic relationship. And mm-hmm. when you're speaking to somebody who's neurotypical, it's a lot different. I can say that.
Yes.
It's a lot different. And so when you look at somebody who's neurotypical, I mean, and I can say this with my current relationship, there's a lot of little, nuances, and I don't want to say game because it's not really a game, but there's no better way to put it, the game of love.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to say any advice to somebody who's neurotypical, who's in a relationship with somebody who's autistic, what would you tell that person? Because their vision of a relationship may be very different than, mm-hmm. not that you wouldn't want the same things, but the vision of how this relationship goes,
right.
can be very different from somebody who's autistic. And I can even say that my relationship in the sense of being a sister is different between mm-hmm. my neurotypical
yeah.
sister and my autistic sister. So what advice would you have for somebody who's neurotypical entering a relationship with somebody who's autistic?
Well, what this makes me think of is several organizations that I am familiar with that run support groups for a spouse or partner of someone who is on the spectrum. It's for neurotypical spouses or partners. And the thing that I always think of is you think that you need to be in a support group because you're in a relationship with someone on the spectrum. We need to be in a support group because we're in a relationship with a neurotypical. We need help as much as you do. Okay? You confound us as much as we confound you. Because you don't really see support groups for people with Asperger's or autism who are in a relationship with a neurotypical. But maybe you should. Because there's as much adjustment that needs to go on our side of the fence as there is on yours. And we might be sitting here thinking, this person is pretty awesome, and I'm happy to be in a relationship with them, but they've got some weird ideas about what we're supposed to be doing. I thought we were just going to sit home and watch Star Trek every night. That's awesome for me. Why can't we do that? They want to, like, go out to restaurants and stuff. That's weird. So we're as much trying to adjust to you as you are to us. Any relationship, whether the person is on the spectrum or dealing with any sort of issue, requires an adjustment. Because it's how sometimes two people in a relationship, they move in together, they end up living together. In any case, in any relationship, whether or not you're physically living with a person, you're moving in mentally. You're living together in the brain space. You're moving into each other's brains, and you have to end. That requires an adjustment. That requires making room for the other person. So you are trying to make room for us. You're trying to squeeze us in. Well, we're trying to squeeze you in because we have things that are important, that are as important to us as they are as the things that are important to you. So I would say, realize that you're not the only one struggling with certain things at times, and that I recently actually got an email from a young man who said that he was just in a relationship with a girl he suspected had Asperger's, but they broke up. He said, oh, physically it was incredible. It was unlike any relationship I've ever had, but we just couldn't communicate. And I feel, he said the communication was terrible. We couldn't talk or do whatever. And all I could think is there's more ways to communicate than talking. So I think if you're a neurotypical and you're in a relationship with someone who is on the spectrum, don't expect things to follow a regular path. Don't look for the traditional relationship, yellow brick road. Because odds are our brick road is going to be puce and violet and orange and magenta. Because that's how we roll, all right? That's pretty much it.
Well, and the other thing that I just want to throw in there, because that's true. I mean, I'll tell you that my brick road is not yellow. It's mm-hmm. it's nice and paved and even. And I know that Jessica, and I love her, and she is my other half. She would want to bulldoze that road.
Mm-hmm.
She would want to tear it up and turn it into rainbow with, Sailor Moon lampposts and unicorns and right. rainbows and right. put hills in and maybe put, you know, different mm-hmm. barriers so that I have to jump over them because
yeah.
that could be funny to watch.
About moving in, when we're moving into to your head and you're moving into our head, if we're moving in, expect us to decorate in every sense of the word.
Jessica's room is very colorful, I will say that. A lot of pink. The other thing I wanted to throw out there is that, you know, if you're a husband or a wife of somebody who is on the spectrum, you need to be aware that
Hello? 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 Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Oh, wow. I don't know
Hi.
What just happened.
Oh, that was strange. Okay.
I've never had that happen, ever.
Okay.
You know, what I was going to say, what was I going to say? Basically that, you know, if you're in a relationship with somebody and it is a long-term and committed relationship, the two things I would say are, you know, you need to be really sensitive to any sensory issues, any issues that manifest themselves that you just can't control.
Right.
You know, if somebody has a sensory issue relating to the color yellow, you know, don't go painting all of your rooms yellow. There are other colors.
Right.
Yes. You know, and so that's part of being in that relationship. You know, you got to deal with it and you got to make accommodations for that. The other thing that I would say is that, you know, when you're talking, and this could be applied to just about any relationship, but I think it's even more important when you're dealing with somebody who's autistic, you know, the way that, you know, somebody who's autistic frames love and shows love is very different from somebody who's neurotypical. You know,
yes.
My sister's way of showing me love is to give me a hug and to show me all of her Sailor Moon stuff, all of her new anime stuff, all of her... Now, I show love to my sister by, you know, buying her gifts and wanting to go out with her and doing all of mm-hmm. these things that she is not at all interested in. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole let's sit and watch Star Trek, you know, if your partner wants to sit and watch Star Trek with you, that could be yeah. like the ultimate showing of love because
right.
that's their love. And you know, especially if you're talking about somebody who has a fixation like my sister does, sharing that
mm-hmm.
fixation is the ultimate, like, pinnacle of I really care about you, I really love
yes.
you, I want you in my life, and you may hate Sailor Moon and wish she would go back to Japan, but I really want to show you this movie. And so, you know, that's really the other point that I would say, you know, you're not necessarily going to get the big bouquet of flowers. You're not going to
yeah.
necessarily get the romance because those things are societal constraints that are learned.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you know, for you to learn them, you got to be real specific about
mm-hmm.
it.
My ex-boyfriend, the only boyfriend I really officially had, I believe had Asperger's, although he was not diagnosed. And I remember he went to Disney World once with his family while we were dating on vacation. And, you know, when you have a significant other who goes on vacation, they might bring you back a present. And this is the first significant other I'd ever had. So I was so excited. Oh, what's he going to bring me? Maybe a bracelet or something. It's Disney. You could be anything. And he brought me back the Twilight Zone companion book. So So any ideas I had clearly went out the window at that very moment. But I believe I really was dating Sheldon Cooper at that juncture. So as you said, you're not going to see the traditional perhaps displays of love or romance that you might expect. But it doesn't mean that the way that a person on the spectrum shows love or romance is bad. It's just different.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it definitely is, because even with my sister, you know, she goes and shuts herself in her room a lot, and that just, that gets me so bad, because I'm like, I'm here to spend time with you, and her response is, let's watch Sailor Moon together, and it's like, I want to go play mini golf, and but that doesn't mean she doesn't love or care about me as her sister. It just means that's the way that she does it, and at a certain point, it's now a compromise, you know, and that's really important. And that's really important when it comes to a sexual relationship with somebody on the spectrum as well. You know, it has to be something that they're comfortable with. And everything you said earlier about the whole trust issue, though, you know, those things have to be on that person's terms.
Yes.
And it can't be forced, because it's so easy to take advantage of somebody whose rules are framed really by a first-come, first-served basis. That's a lot like my sister. Well, in this situation, this is how it went, and so that's how it's addressed in every situation. And that's, unfortunately, in the crazy world of the neurotypical, that's not at all the case. You know, and it is very important, you know. So, Amy, was there, now, you said you were writing a book?
Yes.
And we're going to hawk it, because if any of you guys out there are publishers or you're listening and you know somebody who knows somebody, I've heard, and we kept it pretty PG today. I'm very pleased with that. I've heard some of Amy's stories. They are great. And we got to hear them on the train, and they were hysterical. They were funny. There were a lot of great stories about body image and things like that. So if you guys are out there and you're and you know somebody who would be interested in this, find Amy. Amy, where can we find you?
Thank you, Jocelyn. I have had some interest actually expressed from Future Horizons, which is the same publishing company that does Temple Grandin's books and DVDs and such. But I do have a book proposal, and I'm trying to get that out there. And if you want to find me, very easy, amygravino.com is my website. Everything about me is on there. I also have a blog that I'm trying to update with more regularity. And there's a link to my blog on amygravino.com. So amygravino.com, that's your one-stop shop for everything Amy Gravino. And I also have a Facebook fan page. So if you look me up on Facebook, you can like my fan page on there.
And you should. She's great. Like I said, I've met her in person. I know her. And she as I'm speaking about you, like you're not in the room with me. Amy's a great person.
I'm not in the room with you.
That's true. That's true. Amy's a great person, and you know, I just want to. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I wanted to take a moment. Amy, thank you so much. I hope that you'd be willing to come back and talk about any other subject. You can talk about sex again. You can talk about whatever's on your mind. And I think Maria would be stepping back in at some point. But if she doesn't, this is Inner Sight Radio. I've been your host tonight, Jocelyn Davis with Maria Illu. And our guest tonight was Amy Gravino. And Amy, have yourself an absolutely lovely night.
Thank you so much, Jocelyn. Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And good night, everybody.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah?
You can hang up.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I didn't know if it went off the air, if we were still going to talk after it went off or something.